One is familiar with Buddhist traditions, particularly in the of the southern Buddhist world, Theravada Buddhist world. It's the most ordinary, normal thing that on the moon days we have a ritual taking of the precepts, or just as we do here at Amravati every Saturday, Sunday morning, people come, take the five precepts, and according to the discipline of the nuns and monks, every fortnight on the moon days, we recite our whole rule. So today, this is the full moon day, so this afternoon the monks had their Patimokkha recitation, reciting the whole 227 major precepts that we live by. The nuns had their own recitation of their Sikkhapada, their rules. And just now, you know, the lay community determined their three refuges and the eight precepts. And this is very familiar to us. This is a very much an ordinary part of our routine. It's the style of the religion, but it's significant, I think, to consider that it's the things are not done the same way in every religion, and the process of, say, establishing the precepts that we live by, the ground rules for our conduct, the agreed ways of behavior, and reciting the whole sort of the whole rule book, as it were, every 2 weeks is something that I feel is quite significant. When people ask what's the difference between Buddhism and other religions, one of the things that I find I will stress or will make much of is the fact that there's no real ceremony in order to become a Buddhist. In other religions you have, say in Christianity you have a baptism to become a Christian, or other religions you're born into it. So if you're Jewish, you're born Jewish, or if you're a Brahmin, you're born as a Brahmin. Yeah. Comes with birth, and then that's your religion, whether you like it or not. It comes with the package. But I feel it's a very particular approach that the Buddha made in terms of his teaching, the Buddha Sasana, and that there's no specific way that you become a Buddhist, but rather these customs that we have of taking refuge, coming and reciting these qualities. Buddhang saranam gacchami, I take refuge in the Buddha. Dhammang saranam gacchami, I take refuge in the Dhamma. Sanghang saranam gacchami. And we do it over and over and over again. And we recite the various precepts over and over again, whether we live by the five precepts or the eight precepts, the precepts of the nuns or the monks. We recite it over and over again. And I feel this is a very specific, skillful means that the Buddha established, because I remember many years ago, someone asked me, well, why do you do it like that? And I answered, well, because of the erosion problem. They looked at me like, erosion? Like, what's that got to do with, you know, erosion meaning like the rain washing away the banks of the river, or wearing away the pavement, but it's, you know, erosion of our good intentions, erosion of our faith, things that we have say established. Yes, I want to live this way. Yes, these are the highest values for me: wisdom, truth, virtue. Yes, and then there's erosion. Our good and noble intention gets declared one day, and then a week later it's a little bit weaker, a month later it's a little bit weaker, 6 months later, a year later, it's got considerably weaker and more pale, faded away. And so I feel that the the forms established by the Buddha and in this tradition are extremely skillful, because rather than just having one ceremony where you say Buddhang Saranang Gacchami and you take the Buddha as your refuge and that's sort of supposed to be it for the rest of your life, rather we recognize that it's helpful to us to keep reaffirming, assessing what are the things that are guiding my life. You know, I have the ideal of being wise and being awake. Am I living that way? How's it working out? I take refuge in Dhamma. I'm choosing to live in accordance with reality. Well, how much time am I dwelling in how I think things should be or how they might have been, complaining about how things ought to be? How much time do I dwell in those states of mind? Do I really take refuge in Dhamma, or do I take refuge in my opinions? You know, how's it going? What am I doing? So these customs, these traditions, it's the full moon day, therefore we take the precepts, recite the monastic rule and so on. This is not just a custom because it's a custom, but it's a very specific aspect of spiritual training that over and over again we bring our attention to these qualities and refresh them, reconsider them. How's it going? What's my progress like? Are things going well? Are things falling apart? And then the opportunity to reestablish that value system, to reassert it. It's also something worthy of consideration that and it was something I was reflecting on with the monks and novices today, how the Buddha established one specific ritual meeting that has to happen every fortnight, and the meeting is to recite the monastic rule. So even though he would say that his teaching is about ending suffering, his teaching is about realizing Dhamma, it's a significant thing that when we all gather together, and every monk, every nun has to be there, unless you're extremely sick and you really can't get out of your sick bed. Everybody has to be there. It's a completely obligatory. So you're compelled to be there. You have to be there. But rather than gathering together to say recite the qualities of Nibbana, or to recollect the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, what we recollect is the training rules. What we meet around the sort of the one immovable, non-negotiable meeting that we have that has to happen every fortnight and has been happening ever since the time of the Buddha. It has to happen every fortnight, every new moon, every full moon, regardless whether you like it or not. And you have to be there whether you like it or not. But that's an extremely strong emphasis. But what we meet around, the centerpiece of that meeting is our training rules, our agreements that we have with each other as to how we shall live, what the standards are for our speech, for our actions, how we relate to our possessions, how we relate to our dwelling place, how we relate to other men, to other women, to the material world. Well, that's worthy of consideration. And it's good to reflect upon. Oh, why would the Buddha make so much of that? Why would he say give such a central position to the training rules? Because we can easily think, well, the most important thing is the Dhamma, realizing the truth, awakening to Nibbana. This is the thing that is absolutely central, most important, and the kind of do's and don'ts, the rules. It's just the kind of insignificant customs and just things of the material world. They're just conventions. They don't really matter. what really matters is ultimate truth, your realization of Nibbana. That's the key thing. That's what's important. And it's easy for us to just be dismissive. Oh, it's just a custom, or it's just a rule, so it's just a tradition. We don't have to really bother. It's not important. You know, all sankharas are empty. You know, all things are impermanent. You know, just don't be attached. And we might think that way, but one time, and many of you will have heard Lumpo Samedo quote this, when he was staying at the monastery of Ajahn Buddhadasa, then this was a theme that Ajahn Buddhadasa spoke on a few times, and saying that the rules really are of secondary importance, and what is central is the quality of wisdom, mindfulness. And as long as you're mindful, then everything else follows from that. You don't, the details of the rules are insignificant. I'm paraphrasing. I wasn't there, obviously. It was a long, long time ago when Lumpo Samedo was a junior monk. But it caused him to have a lot of doubts, because at Ajahn Chah's monastery, the rules were observed very, very strictly and in great detail. And as I've been saying, they were definitely given prime importance. So when he went back to Lumpo Cha and he asked him about this, and he said, you know, well, Ajahn Buddhadasa says all you have to do is to be mindful, and you know, the details of all the rules and everything that's said in the Vinaya commentaries, the Pubhasikaya Vanana, that's all really secondary. It's all, you know, basically insignificant. Doesn't really matter that much. As long as you're mindful, then that's the only important thing. And what Lumpo Cha said to him was, "Tuk de mai ching, ching de mai tuk," which is a Thai expression. I think he conjured up at that very moment, which means it's true, but it's not right. It's right, but it's not true. So, which is to say, yeah, you can make a case for that, but that's not really the way that the world works. It's you can say that, and that's not incorrect, but there's more aspects to the picture. That's how I would interpret that. It's also a phrase you could pick up and consider for many days or many weeks. It's true, but it's not right. It's right, but it's not true. One of the questions that the Buddha was asked one time by Venerable Sariputta, I believe, was he was asking about the Buddhas of the past ages that were known of and spoken of in this tradition, the Buddha Vipassi, Buddha Sikhi, Vesabu, the Buddha Konagamana, Kassapa, Kakusanda, the previous Buddhas that were mentioned in the scriptures, and he asked, how was it? What was the nature of the sasana in the times of the Buddha Vipassi, or the Buddha Sikhi, or the Buddha Vesabu, and how long did they last? And did they last a long time, or did they last a short time? And then the Buddha Gautama, a Buddha of our age, said, well, in some of the lifetimes of those Buddhas, the sasana, the dispensation, lasted a long time, many, many ages. And others, it only lasted really as long as their own lifespan. It lasted a short time, but you know, not long after their own life of that particular Buddha came to an end, then the sasana dissolved and was forgotten. And then the Venerable Sariputta asked, well, what was the cause? What was the reason why in some of those Buddha's dispensations the teaching lasted a long time and some a short time? And the Buddha said, well, it was because the ones who established the Patimokkha discipline, the monastic rule in their era, the teaching lasted a long time. And the ones who didn't establish a specific rule, then the teaching disappeared very quickly. And he gave the example of flowers. If you have a lot of separate blossoms, individual flowers, kind of the blossoms of particular flowers, if they just put on a board or on a table, if the wind comes along, they're blown away and scattered and lost very, very easily. But if the flowers are joined together by a thread in a mala, in a garland, then the wind can blow, but the flowers will stay together. They don't scatter and dissipate. And he said in exactly the same way, the thread that holds the flowers together is that of the Vinaya, or the monastic rule. So we can indeed say that, well, the most important thing is the ultimate truth and the realization of that ultimate truth, but the way that the conditions are established, that truth can be most easily recognized, is through our conduct, if you can follow that. So it's absolutely correct that the most important thing is the realization of Nibbana, these sort of transcendent teachings, and that the practice of Dhamma. But the conditions whereby that Dhamma can be realized, they need to be considered. And what the monastic rule, the precepts, what they help us to do is those precepts create the conditions. They create most supportive and helpful environment within which that truth can be realized. The truth is still there, and it's still the most important thing. But if the environment is chaotic or confused or conflicted, if there's a lot of tension and stress and difficulty, then the conditions to, that might support the recognition, the realization of that truth, they're not there. They're obstructed. It's like the room is filled with smoke, or it's filled with loud noise and chaotic activity. Then the space in the room is still here, but it's hard to discern the space when there's all this smoke and noise and busyness and activity. But if the room is clear, there's no smoke, there's no noise, there's no busyness, then the space in the room is very, very obvious. It's very clear, very noticeable. It's immediately and directly apparent. So in this respect, and this is very much a theme of Lumpur Cha's teaching, Lumpur Sumedho also, is the respect for the rules, the traditions, the customs, and that even though they are conventions, they're ordinary, conditioned truths, they're just aspects of the world, they are very significant. And if you bear in mind, this is the one obligatory meeting that we have in our calendar that has to happen every 2 weeks, is going through in the whole rule book, reciting all of the structures of our discipline and our conduct. That's the importance of it. Because when we live by common agreements, when we live in ways that are very simple, that are noble, that are respectful, that conduce to clarity and a quality of gentleness in the way we speak, in the way that we act, then we're creating the ideal conditions wherein the truth of the Dhamma can be recognized. So I feel this is the thing to understand or to consider, that the prime purpose of all of the precepts that we have is simplicity, so that we can live in the most simple way. We're clearing the air of dense and personal emotions, and creating as much of a quality of concord and ease as is possible to do as human beings, so that we obviously still have our bodies, our minds. We still are human beings with all kinds of different habits, but by establishing the routines that we follow by. We follow, like, okay, we as nuns and monks don't help ourselves to food from the kitchen. We wait until food is offered to us. We don't have any money. We don't use money. And so you don't have rich monks, poor monks, you know, rich nuns, poor nuns. Everybody's the same. We all have no money. We're all celibate. None of us have got, you know, partners or friends having sexual relations with each other affairs and contacts, and then having exes, people that we'd like to be with, people that we used to be with that we're finding it difficult to still have around. We don't have to deal with any of that. The simplicity of living in relationship of being sisters and brothers to each other, just living in that in non-sexual relations. It creates an enormously potent environment of simplicity. It helps the air to be really clear of that kind of sort of dense emotional vibration, dense sort of emotional qualities that are naturally there when people are forming couples and having offspring or in relationship, and then depending on each other, and then relationships getting strained and people breaking up, and then talking to each other and not talking to each other. I think we all know the territory. And if we consider how much simpler it is to be in a zone where that kind of activity, that way of relating, just doesn't apply, and how freeing that is for many people coming to stay as a lay guest in the monastery, is this long sigh of relief. I can live with other women, other men, and be living in a group of people and not have to be playing games, not have to worrying whether I'm being attractive or afraid that I'm being too attractive or finding somebody else attractive. I can just put that all aside. You know, those energies can still operate, and they still arise on their own, but we don't have to feed them. We don't have to make anything of them. We can just live in a way where we're choosing not to be guided by that. What a relief! How marvelous! What a blessing! And in the world, it's a rare opportunity to be able to live this way. Yeah, you know, so many people in the workplace, around in the world, in casual context, the mind is continually filled with concerns about how do I look? Am I attractive? Am I unattractive? Sizing other people up, you know, the mind moving towards its sort of judgment about whether there's an opportunity to engage with someone or not. And huge amounts of energy and effort and concern get created around that, as we all know. And a monastery, a place like this, is a unique and special environment whereby all of that can just be put aside, that those dynamics are part of nature, but we don't have to be guided by that. We don't have to be dominated by that. Similarly, the things that we possess, we don't have to be impressing each other with how rich we are, or the special things that we have, or the kind of achievements that we have, whether we have university degrees or whether we are coming from a famous background, or an upper class person, or have a unique family history. None of that has any meaning or value here. It's all put aside. So when we consider these aspects of the life within the monastery, we realize that the living by the precepts, living by these values of renunciation that we have, these are all very skillful and applicable structures. They're very skillful forms that help us to live in the most simple way possible as human beings. just to have enough food to fill our stomachs and keep the body alive and healthy, just to have enough clothing to keep us protected from the elements, and to dress in a modest way, to have a dwelling place, just enough to keep the rain off, keep ourselves cool in the summer, and warm enough in the winter. That's all. And the recitation of the rules, the reiteration of the precepts, it's helping us to recollect, oh, these are the standards I've chosen to live by, and these are the standards that everyone else that I'm living with has chosen to live by. These are our agreements. And by refreshing our memories to bring that to mind and to recollect that, then it helps to sustain that environment of equality, the environment of simplicity, the environment of sanctuary. And that's no small thing. That creates the ideal conditions for awakening to happen, so that it is just conditioned and aspect of the material world, the conditioned and the formed, the originated, but it's not insignificant. It's deeply important, deeply relevant to our lives, because that is what creates the ground, the atmosphere wherein that realization can most directly and completely be brought to fulfillment. We've entered upon the winter retreat time together, and so we have this period for formal practice, either as a group for the next couple of weeks, and then the schedule will modify as the weeks proceed. Parts of the day will be open, parts of the day will be group practice. And some of us delight in practicing meditation together with other people, and others of us much prefer to be alone. And the times we have to quote unquote be with others, it's a sort of endurance test, like group practice. How many more days of this we got? And the mind longs for the opportunity for solitude. And it's important to recognize, well, that's a habit of mind. I'm inclined towards enjoying solitude, and that inclined towards resenting or feeling burdened by the need to practice meditation with others. That's a feeling. That's an attitude that is here. It's not good, it's not bad, but if we want to learn, then we recognize that's my disposition. That's my nitsaya, my character. I want to be alone. I like to be by myself. Other people get great energy and great inspiration. They delight in practicing with other people. And when we have the open schedule and there's no group practice, then that's the real struggle, the feeling really adrift and lost and really longing to get back together and to all be sitting together with the group in the temple. If that's the case, then again, that's not good, that's not bad, but it's simply our disposition, our character. And so that's what we can look at and reflect. Oh, here am I struggling with being alone in my room, or struggling being without a schedule, without a structure, without a routine. That's what this is. This is a feeling of struggling and longing to have a routine to follow. That's what this is. If we're skillful, then we have an open-hearted attitude towards what we like and what we dislike. I was saying this the other day, but it's the sort of thing that can be said over and over and over again. Because it's so easy for us to discriminate, to be biased. Like, But what I like is good, and what I don't like is bad. It is good to, it's great to all practice together. It's great. And it is really difficult. It's really, tough and unpleasant to have to not have a routine, not have a schedule. It is that way. Or the opposite. No, it is great to be by myself. I love it. It's great. It's fantastic. And yeah, it is a real chore to be meditating with everyone else because, you know, people are always making noises and people coming and going in the temple. And it's just the sense of being crowded all the time and having to follow it. You know, what the system is doing, having to only move when the bell goes. And it's awful. I hate it. Why do we have to do that? So easy for us to believe those kind of judgments. And so in this respect, I encourage again this to say, take a step back and recognize this is my preference. This is the feeling of liking, the feeling of approving. This is something that my mind likes. That's what it is. It's not good, it's not bad. We don't have to believe the statements of our moods. And as Lumpur Cha would often say, liking and disliking are of equal value. But it takes an effort to step back from those judgments to be able to recognize, oh, this is the feeling of disliking. That's what this is. It takes effort to do that because the mind so easily just picks up the mood and believes in it, saying, no, this is awful. I don't like this. And it takes that to be an absolute truth. This is awful. I don't want to have to deal with this. Well, this is great. There's a judgment, there's a feeling, the mind takes hold of it and buys into it, believes in it so easily. If we want to practice Dhamma, then we have to realize that these are just moods, they're just mind states. The practice of Dhamma is knowing this is a mind state. Okay, as the Buddha defines it in the Satipatthana Sutta, he's speaking about jitanupassana, that knowing the angry mind is angry, knowing the mind free of anger is free of anger. Knowing the contracted mind is contracted, and the expanded mind is expanded. Knowing the agitated mind is agitated, and the mind free of agitation is free of agitation. There's a whole long list of, I think, 16 different qualities. So that's how mindfulness is established. It's not praising expansiveness and criticizing contractedness. It's not praising freedom from anger and criticizing anger. It's just recognizing this is the mood of the moment. This is the mind liking. This is the mind disliking. This is the mind experiencing this particular quality. That's what's here. And that simple stepping back to know a mood as a mood, it's not a huge effort. It's not like the effort of carrying around a huge rock, but it's a particular effort. We have to recognize this is a judgment. This is the mind taking hold of something and saying, I dislike. This is the mind saying, I like. That's what's happening. So with that small amount of effort applied in the right way, then it gives a whole different perspective on liking and disliking. This is how the heart can be freed. So the example that I give, or the way I like to describe this, is like the effort of taking a key and putting a key in the lock. And if it's the right key, then it's not a huge effort to pick up a key and put it in the lock and turn it. It's not like you need a lot of muscle. But if you take the right key and you put it in the lock and then you turn it, then you can... You can free yourself from being stuck in that particular place. You can get through the door. If you don't use the key, you can't get through the door. You're stuck. So, in this way, the kind of effort that we need to develop mindfulness of moods. It's just that a very small but very specific kind of effort, the effort to recollect this is the judgment, this is the mind approving, this is the mind disapproving, this is the feeling of succeeding, and it's a feeling of success, it's sweet, this is the feeling of failure, it's bitter. When you're praised and someone admires you or praises you for your good efforts or your kindness, being praised has a sweet feeling. That's all. It's a sweet feeling. Being criticized, being blamed, it's a bitter feeling. But and even though you can hear these words, and we know praise is just a feeling, criticism is just a feeling, liking is just a feeling, disliking is just a feeling. We might hear these words and go, oh yeah, right, of course, that makes total sense. Yeah, obvious. Completely obvious. But then, an hour later when we, or not even an hour later, 5 minutes later, there's a feeling of dislike and we're right into it. We just jump right in and grab hold of it and take it as ours. A feeling of liking, approving. We jump right in, take hold of it and believe in it completely. So I like to emphasize this aspect of practice because it makes such a difference to develop that habit of recognizing, oh, what this is a mood, this is the mind approving, disapproving, this is a sweet feeling, this is a bitter feeling, ha, that's all it is. Also, speaking of preferences and moods, one of the things that I've noticed that people quite prefer not to do is when we have these late night vigils, and Amravati, the late night vigils only go to midnight, don't even go through till the early morning of morning chanting at 3 or 4 in the morning. But we finish these at midnight, but still, there do tend to be an awful lot of empty seats on the monastic front during the course of the evening, so people I understand may strongly prefer to be practicing by themselves, but I would encourage that also that it's a good opportunity to look at that feeling of I want to be by myself, I don't want to be bothered, I don't want to be bothered being in the temple, to look at that feeling and to look at the feeling in the temple rather than in your room or in your kuti, and to actually make the effort to be spending time practicing together with others rather than just sort of retreating to our favored little domain of our kuti or our room. If we always follow our preferences, then we never develop the strengths of a patient endurance. If we always follow the path of least resistance and pursue our likes, run away from our dislikes, then we never develop the kind of strength, and the heart is always being limited by choosing the preferred option. We never learn how to be free of that kind of bias. Because the freedom comes from knowing, liking and disliking. Freedom doesn't come from always being able to pursue your likes. because we can do that. We can follow what we like and we can get what we like a certain amount of the time. But if that's our refuge, if that's our habit, always trying to find happiness through getting what we like, then when we can't get what we like and when things don't go the way that we choose, then we have no refuge. If we're always trying to find happiness through getting away from what we dislike, and we develop skills how to avoid what we dislike, then when what we do, those times when we're stuck with something that we dislike and we can't get away from it, it's not avoidable. Then we have no refuge. We have only got suffering. We only have dukkha to keep us company. So freedom, the quality of nisarana, is through knowing, liking and disliking. Knowing the sweet and the bitter, and not compulsively chasing after what we like and trying to find happiness through always getting what we like, or trying to find happiness through always avoiding what we dislike. But the real freedom is the training of the heart to be that awareness that knows this is disliking, this is liking, and to not be making an identity, to not be, say, forming an entangled attachment, a grasping attachment to like or dislike, but to know this is the flavor of liking, this is the flavor of disliking, that's all. We chanted the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta this evening. So that teaching, this simple teaching, takes 20 minutes or so to recite, 25 minutes. Many of these most important principles of the Dhamma teachings are contained within that. When we say Rupang Anatta, the body is not self. Vedana anatta, feelings are not self. Sanya anatta, perceptions are not self. Sankara anatta, mental formations are not self. Vijnana anatta, consciousness is not self. The kind of, if we really want to, actualize those teachings, to see those qualities directly and to know them for ourselves, then just what I've been describing is the most helpful way to see that feelings are not self. If we're always pursuing feelings, we're chasing after the ones that we like, running away from the ones that we dislike, then those feelings are self. They are me and mine. There's a grasping, a claiming, an identifying. But if we take those teachings seriously, feelings are not self, Vedana anatta, sanya, sankara anatta, then it's through this kind of method of knowing a feeling just as a feeling, knowing a mood just as a mood, to not be blindly pursuing what we like or running away from what we dislike. That's how that truth of anatta is actualized, is realized directly. We might tell ourselves that that feelings are not self, and I'll just follow these nice ones, and all feelings are all moods and feelings are not self, but I'll just mindfully run away from the ones that I dislike. And we can do that, and I've done a lot of. I speak about this because I've done a lot of this myself. It's this familiar territory, but also it's practicing Dhamma means not lying to ourselves, being truthful, being honest to ourselves, being honest about what's going on, and so then if we see that the mind is still taken up with those kind of biases. Chasing after what we like, running away from what we dislike, then if there's a sincere looking, an honest and sincere looking, then we'll recognize, well, there's definitely identification going on here. There's the mind is caught up, is taken up with pursuing what we like, pursuing what I like, running away from what I dislike, and I'm just labeling it all anatta as a sort of kind of it's all not self, but I'll choose this one. It's a kind of you've got a sort of a label on the bottle says anatta, but inside, there's still that definite attachment, identification. The mind is still claiming those feelings as who and what we are, as me and mine. So these simple kind of practices, just knowing a mood as a mood during the course of a day. Yeah. When we succeed, when we're praised, notice how sweet that feels. When we fail or things go wrong, notice how bitter that is. That's all. It's not complicated. It's not anything special or remote. When we lose something, when something that we had is lost or broken, to notice, well, this is the feeling of loss. This is what losing feels like. It's like this. When we get something or are given something or we create something, this is the feeling of gaining, of getting, of having. Feels like this. It's not complicated or even very refined, but simply to notice this is what gain is like, this is what loss is like, this is what success feels like, this is what failure feels like. Just simply taking the trouble to note those qualities of experience, this opens up the whole field of our lives. It creates an enormous spaciousness, a freedom, and a quality of security. In a way, this is you're really taking refuge. The sarana, the refuge, is really established. The heart is in a safe place. It's secure because the heart is established where things can't knock it over, where the winds of success and failure, praise and criticism, gain and loss, happiness and unhappiness, don't blow the heart around. The heart has taken refuge where there's a real shelter, real sanctuary. Being that very knowing, being that aware, awake, responsive quality, and free from compulsively chasing what we like and fearing and running away from what we dislike. It's not complicated, but it's challenging. It's not easy to do, but if we make the effort, that simple, steady, consistent effort to keep knowing our moods, to see those pulls upon the heart, to know what they are, then this is the way that our potential for freedom can be realized. It's not far away. It's always accessible to us each moment, every moment. That door, the door to the deathless, is always right here. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.